Afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It is a pleasure to be here, and thanks to you, Mike, and thanks to you, Fran, for having me over here. I realize that it is a beautiful day outside, a Halloween Sunday. You would much rather spend your time outside. So I would like to make up for it, and hopefully I'm going to give you some tidbits on where the entire world is from a macro view in terms of agriculture, the opportunities that we have in agriculture, nutrition, and general well-being. There are indeed a number of major changes that are occurring on the agricultural frontiers. And we in the Malaysia Life Sciences Capital Fund and in Buril Life Sciences, we believe that we could be a part of solutions. And let me start the presentation today by giving you a brief introduction to Malaysia Life Sciences Capital Fund, because it gives you a feel for how developing economies are actually beginning to participate in modern technologies when they are developed in the United States or Western Europe, and they're beginning to access those technologies through different modalities. We are a $150 million capital fund. We are a part of what is called the Open Innovation of Malaysia. This is a concept that the former Prime Minister of Malaysia is leveraging. The current government is also leveraging this system. And the objective here is to tap into the boutique companies that are being built using scientific developments here in the Western Hemisphere. We are today fully invested, and I'll give you a feel for the companies that we have invested in. And we have two objectives. As venture capitalists, we always have to return the money and make some money, which is number one. Number two is to make sure that we make investments in companies that have Malaysia centricity. That is, they have a degree of relevance to the country. Otherwise, we don't make those investments. We have been in operation since 2006. At this point of time, we are one investment away from being fully invested. These are the companies that are in our portfolio. It includes some agricultural biotechnology companies. It includes industrial biotechnology companies and healthcare companies. Chromatin is a company that we invested in. Chromatin is in the business of making synthetic chromosomes. So if you want to transform a palm plant and you want to do that one gene at a time, the way we are modifying canola or the way we are modifying corn, I think I'll be dead and gone by the time you get three or four traits into one crop that can be planted. So the concept is on one chromosome, you stack multiple traits, and within a time period of 10 to 15 years to see that palm tree with multiple traits, whether it is oil modification, whether it is nutrient efficiency, water efficiency, or whether it is related to pest control, all of them being available in that one palm plant at the same time. It is that concept that Chromatin will enable various palm plantations to do, and that's the objective behind this investment. We started a company called Abunda. Abunda is looking at synthetic biology to make number of chemicals of the type Mike talked about, using microorganisms to make classes of flavorants, aromatins, and so forth, which would not only increase the sensory attributes of food, improve the sensory attributes of food in a cost-effective fashion, but also deliver on the health side of the equation. So this company is focused on that. We have a company called Acremin. It is in St. Louis, and it is focused on purifying natural gas and hydrogen using biotechnology. A company called Glory Oil, which is using biotechnology to improve oil extraction efficiency in petroleum oil fields. A company called Muscoma, which is actually transforming lignocellulosic biomass to sugar and a number of other feedstocks that can be used in the feed industry as well as in animal feed. Healthcare companies that are focused on cancer therapy, because liver cancer, colon cancer is highly prevalent in that part of the world, and we need new ways of treating them. Chemotherapy, radiation therapy aren't satisfactory solutions. So we have a broad cadre of portfolios in our company, and our objective is not only to bring solutions to the various people that are looking for these solutions, but also, of course, to grow these companies and make profits. That is not my objective today, to talk about the Malaysia Life Sciences Capital Fund, but to spend a little bit of time on the emerging economies and the opportunities that are ahead of us. I want to leave you with some key messages. Food used to be an afterthought. Food production used to be an afterthought in this country until the year 2006. The year 2007, when we had major shortages in every cereal and we had riots in many parts of the world, changed the name of the game. For the first time, we recognized that production was actually lagging behind demand for various agricultural products. And indeed, such is the case today, and such is the case for the foreseeable future. We have technologies. Some of these technologies do not see the light of the day because of regulatory issues, public perception issues, and so forth, and we need to address that. Having the technologies on hand will not answer questions with respect to the starving mouth or the obese person in another part of the world, or for that matter, even in this country. We need science-based policymaking, science-based regulations. Science-based regulations are needed not only for agriculture, but also for what Mike talked about, for it to see the light of the day. We need those types of systems. When you look at it from the perspective of the emerging economies, agricultural infrastructure is still in its infancy. This needs to change, and I'm going to give you some data on on-farm losses and off-farm losses that are actually avoidable. And though we have the technology, we have the answers to some of these things, and that is where we need to start in order to get this thing rolling in the right direction. Diverse forces are actually shaping the agriculture of today. In fact, we are confused as to whether we are talking about agriculture or agribusiness, because we have romantic illusions of agriculture the way it was perhaps 150, 200 years ago. Unfortunately, that sort of agriculture is not going to feed very many mouths, and agribusiness is a necessity for today. And technology has emerged extremely rapidly, especially biotechnology, and the progress we are making in biotechnology has come a long way. It has the ability to meet the food demands, but along with that, the regulation has to evolve. Our ability to create value and capture value in various markets has to evolve. Trade has to evolve in a different direction. And, of course, environment is also playing a major role, climate change being one such example. But there are a number of other environmental issues as it pertains to ag businesses, especially media, activism, and so forth, which also is something that we should bear in mind. Let's step back and take a look at where we are in agriculture today. Agriculture today spans about 1.2 billion hectares on a global basis. If we were getting paid for the eco-surveys that we conduct, we remove 40 to 60 gigatons of carbon dioxide on an annual basis, and we release a similar tonnage of oxygen on an annual basis, and we harvest less than 1% of the solar energy to feed the 6.8 billion people that inhabit this planet. And we are a key contributor to not only the carbon cycle, but also the nitrogen, the phosphorus, the oxygen, the sulfur cycle, and on and on. And we employ 50% of the global population. Indeed, a tremendous contribution by any measure, and indeed, no wonder that civilization actually started with agriculture, because we have had 10,000 years to get it right. If you look at the business contribution to global economy, it is in the neighborhood of $8 to $9 trillion. You can see that whether it is Europe or Asia, or whether it is North America, there is significant amount of trading that goes on back and forth between these countries. And indeed, this is going to grow, because most of the people who are actually in the category of underserved and undernourished are actually in Asia, whose economy is growing at this point of time. And we need to feed those people. And I'm going to give you data to show that land is not there in Asia. That land has to come from Americas by and large, or Africa. These are the major crops: corn, rice, wheat, soybeans, sorghum, groundnuts, or peanuts, as we call them in this country, cotton. These account for a bulk of what is grown, and indeed a bulk of the agri-economy on a global basis. If you just look at the next 10 years in terms of what we need to increase cereal production by 2% on an annualized basis, 3.5% of oil seeds, and of course we need to grow more of meat and grow more of milk, etc. And if we were to use the same technologies that we used in the past, there is just no way we are going to meet that demand, forget about 2050, even in the year 2020. That's the key message to take, and that improvement has to show up not just in North American or U.S. agriculture. It has to show up in the rice fields in India and China, in Philippines. It has to grow up in the palm fields in Indonesia and Malaysia, as well as in the soy fields and corn fields of Argentina and Brazil. The world vegetable oil demand is going to grow by about 3.3%, because when people become richer, they all want to have fatty and proteinaceous food. And of course, as the economy is growing faster, it is no wonder we have a higher demand. But we need to make sure that we don't put more people in the obesity category that Mike talked about. To give you a snapshot of where we have come from, you can see that we have not increased the yield of several vegetables and oil seeds and fruit and grains at the rate of even 2% on an annualized basis. A few crops have seen them, so it is important that we learn to get the technology more broadly, not just into corn, not just into rice, but also into a number of other crops. You look at the countries whose population is growing and ask the question, where are they in terms of their ability to meet their own demand? You see very quickly that the populous countries of the world, China, India, they not only have a lower yield in terms of grain yield on a hectare basis, but they are significantly behind where they need to be on a per capita basis in terms of calories. So many, many countries of the world need to increase their agricultural productivity, and these countries are in the emerging economies of the world. If our goal in life is to meet the future needs, using the same technologies that we used in the past, we will need more land. If we use more land, the land that has to be brought into agricultural production between now and the year 2050 is equal to the land mass of Brazil. Today, we are harvesting, we are growing and harvesting on an annual basis land mass equivalent to that of South America. And if we want to add to that a Brazil, good luck to you, because there is not that much land. As Mark Twain said many, many moons ago, we don't make land anymore, and that was true then, it is true today. Water. The developed countries have become much more resource efficient with respect to water use. The developing countries use an awful lot of water to produce a very small amount of grain. Water use and land use efficiency in developing world needs to improve. Developing world has seen significant increase in agricultural production by using fertilizers in a major way. Unfortunately, the use of extensive fertilizers in China and in India has now contributed, especially in China, to increased nitrogen concentrations in water. Same thing with respect to phosphorus, and we need to reduce nitrogen inputs and make crops more efficient with respect to their ability to take nitrogen. This is a chart which basically tells you how much over-fertilization is occurring in North China in relationship to Midwest United States or a place like Kenya, which hardly applies fertilization, so you can see the opportunity that exists there. And layer on this the climate change, especially the 2, 3, 4 degrees Celsius warming in temperature that one is expecting, you can see where the hottest regions of the world are going to be, and that too is going to create problems. You can look at everything that I have presented so far and relate to them as problems, but you can also look at them as opportunities for conducting basic research that is required in order to address these emerging issues, not just in the United States, but on a global basis. Unfortunately, as we think of solutions, we have a quandary. The type of agriculture that we want to relate to, is that the Mato Grosso type of agriculture in Brazil, or is that the poor Bolivian farmer who you see on the other side, or an African farmer who basically has to sweat on a day and night basis in order to produce the grain? So whose agriculture is it? Whose vision do we have? Do we want to industrialize the agriculture, or do we want sustainable agriculture where we keep people on the farm? These are some of the issues on which there is a heavy exchange on a daily basis, and I'm not sure it is worth the trouble, because we have to focus on the solutions and systems will evolve, but instead we are spending a lot of time debating about whose agriculture it is. So with that as a backdrop, let me look at the technology and the opportunities that we have and where we can go and how far we can go. Indeed, significant progress was made using breeding, especially the green revolution in rice and wheat, the hybridization of crops, and indeed breeding is going to continue to play a major role in crop improvement for the foreseeable future. In fact, for a long time, I should say. Biotechnology, which has emerged on the scene, has made major contributions in the last 15 years. We have seen just the first inning of the nine-inning game in biotech traits, the opportunity to globalize it in the crops where we have commercialized it, and the opportunity to extend it to other crops is real, but we need to get the regulations in place. Chemistry on the seed is still in its infancy. We have to learn to leverage chemistry on the seed as well as microorganisms on the seed, which I will talk about briefly later on, is something that we haven't even kind of grasped the realm of possibilities with, and these are going to be very important in the future of agriculture. Biotechnology has largely been about pest protection, and indeed it has a place not only because pests cause major losses of crop yields, but also because of the fact that it improves crop reliability. Reliability in agricultural production is an important arena. There are a lot of unmet needs. It enhances sustainability, and I'll give you some examples as we go through this talk. India, which commercialized BT cotton just about 5 years ago, has seen remarkable improvement in cotton yields. Indian cotton yields used to be about 25% of the U.S. cotton yields per acre in 2005. Today, it is 42% of the U.S. cotton yields just because of the introduction of one technology. India uses hybrid cotton. It is the only place in the world where hybrid cotton is used because labor is cheap and they can afford to hand emasculate and produce the hybrid crop. With their hybrid cotton, they should be actually getting 125% of the yield that U.S. is getting. You can see the headspace for growth, but one technology allowed India to literally increase its cotton yield by 25 to 40%, a remarkable contribution to the Indian cotton production. Insect control remains a major target because insects become resistant on an annual basis. Newer and newer insects are emerging, and the same insects that we thought were controlled are no longer being controlled because they undergo mutations, they undergo development. So this is a fight between our controlling agents and insects, and this will continue to be so forever, as long as biology is alive. So the point I want to make to you today is that new insect control agents are needed, and indeed we have discovered a lot of cry genes that have these are the crystalline proteins that are present in Bacillus thuringiensis, which have the insecticidal activity. And of course, we now need these types of agents so that we can engineer crops with these genes and indeed protect the crops against these types of agents. The second one is weed control. Weed control, of course, with Roundup Ready in soybeans gained a lot of acceptance in this country and has made major impact on soy production, not only in this country, but in a country like Argentina, where they're able to grow two crops of soybean on an annual basis. And indeed, Argentina and Brazil are the countries that have benefited most because of introduction of Roundup Ready technology. At the time when this technology was being developed, people used to think of this as bringing about somewhere around 5 to 10% increase in annual yields of soybean. But if you look at a country like Argentina, which has now been able to grow literally two crops of soybean, it has doubled the yield of soybean on an annualized basis in that country. Not only has it increased yield, but it has also contributed to much more sustainable practices like no-till farming or conservation till farming, which has huge impact on the energy used in agriculture and the contribution of that energy to carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases. And these have other benefits, especially the preservation of topsoil, reduced labor use, and of course, organic matter preservation, and so on and so forth. As we look at these types of solutions, we find that we have, again, the battle of the weeds with the control systems that we have. Weed resistance to pesticides or herbicides is a global issue. As of yesterday, 348 species have been reported by the Herbicide Resistance Committee that monitors these things on a regular basis. 114 of these are dicot type of weeds, and 80 of them are monocot species. So this battle will continue, and new solutions are required even here. Many of you, especially those who are born after 1960 or 1970, may not realize that if you were born in the year 1910, the probability that you would spend about 50 or 60% of your time on the farm removing the weeds was very high. In fact, 92% of world's labor was deployed in agriculture to remove weeds in the year 1800 and 1810, other than, of course, fighting battles and making implements to fight battles. So that used to be the major occupation. So if you sum up the amount of time that humans have spent since 10,000 BC, when agriculture started, this has been the most involved, most engaging profession, and I'm glad none of us are engaged in this profession today. But in order for us to be out of that profession, we have to make sure that we have newer control agents, weed control agents. Research is required to understand how weeds actually become resistant. Herbicide like glyphosate, which is a non-selective, non-soil active herbicide, still appears to maintain pressure for evolution. How this occurs is something that we need to understand. And of course, we also need to solve the problems that we have today, which is to address the issue of weed control in the face of weed resistance to herbicides. Tom Clemente, who is sitting here from University of Nebraska, he has been working with his colleagues on dicamba resistance, and Monsanto has now licensed this technology. So dicamba resistance is going to be combined with Roundup Ready so that farmers have the ability to now mix and match herbicides. And with time, we will also see rotation of herbicides where you can have in a single crop multiple resistance mechanisms, and the farmer does not have to rely upon one mechanism or two mechanisms but can rotate amongst various options. This too is emerging. But this is only being seen in four crops: corn, cotton, soybean and canola. The opportunity to extend this to rice, to wheat, and a number of other crops still exists, and no company has done that at this point of time. We have issues when it comes to emerging economies, issues where weeds like striga, they lower crop productivity. Striga is a major problem in cereal cultivation, in sorghum, in corn, and a number of other agricultural situations, especially in Africa. And indeed, an African scientist a few years ago was able to breed sorghum, which was resistant to Striga in the sense that it did not promote Striga infestations, won the World Food Prize just last year. And there are opportunities to make other crops similarly resistant because this particular pest can lower corn yield by 50-60%, sorghum yield by 50-60%, indeed a major problem on an African basis at least. If you thought that insect control and weed control was big enough, hard enough, we now have a series of emerging issues, especially in South Asia and Southeast Asia, where a pest like a rat is now beginning to get into the agricultural field and eat the rice that is ready for harvest. You can see actually in the lower left-hand quadrant the rat damage that has been caused to your rice field right next to the fully filled grain, which has not been damaged. People are now in the process of banding the rats so that they can track the rat movement and make sure that the appropriate rat traps are established, but I'm not sure how we will tackle this problem if we have to tackle this on a global basis. Disease resistance is yet another important arena. Diseases are important not only from the perspective, especially the fungal diseases, from the perspective of the fact that they lower crop yield, but they also produce toxins which belong to the category of not nutrients that we just talked about, but they belong to the category of anti-nutrients. Some of these, especially some toxins like fumonisin, they increase our need for folate, they cause folate deficiency. So if we can get rid of some of these, they actually improve the nutritional attributes of what is already there. And these diseases, they can be controlled via two mechanisms. One, by having direct resistance in the crop to these types of agents. And secondly, of course, by having control of insects, because oftentimes insects pave the path for the fungal diseases to come and establish themselves. So both insect control and disease control can go hand in hand. We are used to using the tools that are available within the germplasm of a given crop, but we need to go beyond that in order to get fungal disease resistance and bacterial disease resistance, because these agents evolve resistance a lot faster than either the insects or the weeds that we talked about. Water is something that people believe we will fight wars about, just as we are fighting on the petroleum side of the equation. This is an important natural resource that we have long taken for granted. If the glaciers melt, especially in the Himalayas, in the Indochina region, and we do not have the usual melting of the snow in the summer months, which feeds that entire region of water and therefore feeds the crops, that is going to cause major problems, and we need to create drought-resistant crops immediately, and this is an important research target. And it is not sufficient to have adequate quantities of water for most of the growing season. There are critical periods during crop growth when you need to have water, and one of them is in the early germination stage, and the second is during the phase of fertilization of the crop. It doesn't matter how much water you had most of the time. If you don't have during the silking period of a crop like corn or during the fertilization period of rice, you have major losses in productivity of those crops. And this is true not only for corn and rice, even a crop like palm. And even in a country like Malaysia, where it rains almost 365 days a year, there are periods when it rains a little less, and you can see palm productivity track the water availability for these crops. So this is an important objective, and we have to pay attention to that. And water management and water use efficiency is not only an important, and drought tolerance is not only an important objective in and of itself, but pest control, and especially root diseases and stem diseases, play a major role. Here is an example of what corn rootworm resistance can do to the water activity of a crop like corn. You can see that a better protected root increases the water activity around the corn roots, and indeed the yields even during drought periods, especially if they have sturdier roots, is generally better than the ones that do not have the sturdy root. The Blue Revolution is, of course, underway. Lots of companies are working on it, but I think we don't have enough solutions today. This is an important endeavor, and I strongly recommend that those of you who are engaged in basic research evaluate this opportunity as well. If you walked away thinking that if we had drought tolerance, we have solved agricultural problems with water, I have news for you. Drought is important, but flooding is just as important. One of the consequences of the global warming is either we have too much water or too little water. Case in point, just this year, Ukraine and Russia had major droughts. A lot of Eastern European countries had major droughts. China and India had lots of floods. So we need crops which are capable of growing anaerobically as well as aerobically. Rice is now being developed, which is capable of withstanding this flooding. And we need more solutions in more crops, crops like wheat, crops like sorghum, crops like corn. They too need these types of solutions. And I am trying to tell you, when you have a lot of water logged in a field, it carries all kinds of other biological agents as well. So it is likely that we'll have new diseases emerging in these situations. Saline agriculture, because water quantity and quality are important. Quality of water, especially salinity, is becoming a major issue. Saline agriculture is now being developed. Countries in Africa, Israel, they are taking active lead. Crops like Salicornia, tomato, which is capable of growing in saline water, these are being developed. Again, saline agriculture is an important emerging need. Nitrogen. Haber and Bosch actually made pioneering contributions in 1906 by inventing their Haber-Bosch process for converting nitrogen to urea, and has been the basis of agricultural fertilization. Let me tell you, Haber-Bosch process is an extremely energy-intensive process, and it's a shame on us that 1906 technology is still the technology that is used. And this is the technology that is, of course, being used to deploy massive amounts of fertilizer in fields in the United States, in China, India, and a number of other countries. We need to improve that process for its footprint characteristics and for its ability to make fixed nitrogen in a decentralized way. If you have to build mega tons of capacity in order to make these things, I think we are asking for trouble. In order for most of those countries that are below their self-sufficiency, this is going to be an important input, and we need to improve technology. And we also need to improve the responsiveness of crops for these fertilizers, and indeed crops like rice, wheat, corn, number of cereals, those are all being developed now for better nitrogen responsiveness. Yield is another important objective. I think yield needs to be approached from every angle. Pest protection is one way of increasing yield, but that doesn't increase the intrinsic yield of the crop. There are now intrinsic yield technologies that are being developed. Here you can see a soybean that has a 5-bean pod. A typical soybean has 3 beans, so 4 beans, 5-bean pods, and having more pods per plant, these are being now approached in soybean in a number of companies, Monsanto, DuPont, and so forth. So products of this technology are likely to see the light of the day in these crops very soon, but we need similar technologies for corn, rice, wheat, and so on. Ladies and gentlemen, I think we made tremendous progress in crops like corn between 1960 and year 2000. Here we use population density per acre as one of the objectives. Instead of growing 8,000 plants per acre today, a typical corn grower plants about 32,000 plants per acre in corn. most of the world still hasn't adopted this technology. There are opportunities to bring these technologies to other parts of the world and also to extend some of these technologies to other crops beyond corn. So planting density is certainly an important arena as well. As we look at these crops, one of the questions, of course, is who will develop these crops and bring those crops to the marketplace. This chart gives you a feel for how much of the corn seed in different parts of the world is controlled by public, how much of it is farmers saved, and how much is through private enterprises. You can see that in countries like China, there are only two categories. There is no saved seed because the government of China is quite demanding in terms of what the grower actually plants. I don't think we can have that kind of a system in countries where democracy exists. In countries like India, for example, there is a blend. The question of who breeds what and why they should focus on certain areas is a topic that one has to pay attention to. Mike talked about golden rice. It is unlikely that any of the big companies would invest in golden rice themselves. That is a good arena for public institutions to focus on, things that would lift the overall quality of a crop. On the other hand, where it is an agronomic trait or a quality trait where companies know how to actually participate, capture value, it seems to me that there is opportunity for private participation. So we need to look at this as an opportunity in the form of public-private partnership. Where are we on a global basis with respect to agricultural productivity? A crop like corn, where companies are actually participating in agriculture in a major way, you can see that United States is approaching 10 tons per hectare yield. None of the countries where corn is a significant crop are coming close to United States. Western Europe used to be close, but with their resistance to biotechnology, they're beginning to lag behind. South America is likely to catch up in the near future. But just by taking existing technologies, giving it the freedom to operate, which means the regulatory signs and the regulatory infrastructure in these countries has to improve, trade has to improve, I think there is an opportunity to improve productivity. And this is so for corn. This is true for a number of other crops as well. In UK, they did a study recently to determine how much of the yield potential in a crop is being realized in wheat and oilseed rape. And we in the United States have been doing the same thing. There is no reason why the genetics of corn that is being cultivated today in the United States does not deliver at least 350 bushels per acre. We are typically seeing 150 to 160 bushels per acre. So the existing genetics has a lot higher potential. We realize only about 50% of that potential. That is true for wheat. That is true for oilseed rape, which tells us that this gene by environment interaction is an important arena to pay attention to. And this gets me to the final portion of what I want to talk to you about, which is the arena of genomics. Progress that we are making in genome sequencing is going to have a huge impact in terms of giving us the tools to look at how these different genes function, the nature of the genes that are responsible for a number of important traits in agronomic situations. I'm very happy to see that the cost of the genome sequencing for the human genome is now approaching $10,000 per human sequence. I think in a matter of 2-3 years, we could be at a $1,000 genome, which means that literally you and I should be able to go and one afternoon get our whole genome sequenced. In fact, that is going to have tremendous implications in lots of human activity, but that is also true for a number of other areas as well. Plant genomes are being now sequenced on a routine basis. We ourselves sequenced the palm genome, working with Malaysian Palm Oil Board last year. It's a simpler genome, although it's a bigger plant and a more complex plant than corn. So we are in the process of understanding the palm genome a lot more. But this is true for every other crop that exists on the planet. And if you look at how breeding has developed over the course of the last 100 years, we find that we have actually tapped into a very narrow sliver of the germplasm. It doesn't matter whether we are dealing with rice or wheat or corn or sunflower or tomato, you could put your favorite crop on the pie chart. Somewhere between 1 to 10% of what is available is what's being tapped. So we have the opportunity to go back and understand how these different alleles are contributing to different phenotypes in these crops. Let me make a very important point here. Teosinte became corn. That gene that was responsible, or the genes that were responsible for the mutation of teosinte into corn, we know is a major yield gene. How many different alleles exist for those major yield genes? What does it take to get them introgressed into the modern corn material? And what the phenotype is of those different alleles? We don't have a clue at this point of time, but stay tuned is the message. And this is all enabled because of the progress that I talked to you about in the genome sequencing arena. There are not only great genes of the type that I described for teosinte to corn, there are also a number of hidden genes. In fact, Steve Tanksley, a friend of mine at Cornell University, took a very, very small tomato. In fact, it is so small, and the tomato plant yields so little fruit, we shouldn't even call it a tomato. It looks like a weed. And then he crossed that with the modern tomatoes, which are grown in the field, and found that those puny tomato plants contained alleles which could make the modern material grow faster, yield more fruit, and have higher solid content in the fruit. Remarkable finding, which tells us that it is not the appearance of the plant that is important, it is the genetic makeup. And now we have the opportunity to probe these types of things, and going back to the diversity of the crops becomes an important endeavor. There are many, many opportunities of that nature. And indeed, fruits and vegetables is one where I think we can leverage this in a very broad and systematic way. Metabolic syndrome. Mike talked about obesity. I would like to take it to one granular level down and say metabolic syndrome is now a major health issue both in the developed and the developing nations. Childhood obesity is so rampant in China that 1 in 2 now is now demonstrated to be obese in the Chinese system. And Chinese have only one child per family. And you can imagine if 50% of the children of China have this problem, what this can cause in the longer run. And metabolic syndrome is at the heart of many of the conditions that we are talking about. Inflammation, blood pressure, LDL cholesterol, total cholesterol, glucose, these are some of the important metrics that are associated with metabolic syndrome, and we need to address this issue, otherwise we are going to have one sick world on a global basis. Some of the molecules are not present in the food system today. One of them happens to be omega-3 fatty acids. In fact, we took omega-3 fatty acids out of our food because they would go rancid, and we bred soybeans and canola and every other crop so that they have low content of alpha-linolenic acid. We now need to put those back, not just as alpha-linolenic acid, but as stearidonic acid, as eicosapentaenoic acid and docosahexaenoic acid, the more important omega-3s. And indeed, they have so many different metabolic effects that even in the Japanese population, which consumes a lot of fish, it's been demonstrated that if you give them more omega-3 fatty acids, especially eicosapentaenoic acid, you can reduce the incidence of heart attack in Japanese patients. In UK and in the United States, a number of studies have been conducted which say that these are more effective than statins in terms of reducing heart attacks in people who have had one heart attack. And now clinical trials are in progress to see the combination of statins plus omega-3s. So the point I want to make to you, ladies and gentlemen, is that we have taken inadvertently stuff out of our food system that needs to be there, and we now have a molecular basis for why they need to be there. Similarly, there are also a number of other molecules. You may have heard of a molecule called resveratrol. This is supposed to be the answer to French paradox, as to why French actually eat a lot of meat, drink a lot of wine, and still have lower incidence of heart disease and have higher longevity. One molecule, resveratrol, that is present in grapes and wine, has been demonstrated to improve longevity in yeast, in nematodes, and a number of model organisms. There is no data in monkeys, no data in humans, so don't rush and drink more wine. You have to drink 96 glasses of wine to get adequate quantities of resveratrol if the dose in nematodes is to be extended to humans. But the point I want to make here is it is possible to produce tomatoes that have resveratrol, which is exactly what Cathy Martin in England did. She identified tomatoes, the purple tomatoes which actually had resveratrol. The red tomatoes that you get today in the grocery store doesn't have resveratrol. You can indeed just cross these tomatoes and get these pathways constituted. So in addition to biotechnology, there are breeding capabilities along the lines of what Mike talked about, where characterizing the germplasm becomes an important objective. I would like to spend a few minutes on characterizing the biome. Indeed, our biome is the most important organ of our body. For those of you who may not be aware, there are actually 10 to the power of 12 cells of microorganisms in our gut, and that contrasts with somewhere around 10 to the power of 10 human cells that we have. So we are more microbial than we care to admit. And these have tremendous impact on phenotypic outcomes in humans. A friend of mine, Jeff Golden at Washington University, took a pair of twins, homozygous twins, one who was obese and one who was not obese, and introduced the microflora from the obese twin into germ-free mice and from the lean twin to the germ-free mice. And within a few days, the one that had derived the microflora from the obese twin, they became obese, and they were obese for 6 weeks, whereas the ones that had received the lean twin's microbiome, they remained lean. It tells us that, indeed, these microorganisms that are resident in our gut have more impact than what we have acknowledged. It is no wonder that fibers and a number of other molecules have huge impact. It has now been demonstrated after some painstaking study at Harvard University over a period of 10 years that people who eat brown rice have a lower incidence of diabetes than those who eat white rice, and those who eat whole wheat have an even lower incidence of diabetes. So if we have to address this issue of impaired glucose tolerance, metabolic syndrome, and prevent full-blown diabetes, type 2 diabetes from emerging, we have got to understand the interaction not just with ourselves, but also with the microbial cells, ourselves, and the food systems. If we were to stop there, that would be exciting, but I think there is an opportunity to leverage some of these tools to understand the plant biome. Plants have exactly the same kind of issues as we do. We have made everything quite sterile, but I think the net result of this is we have also eliminated some of the beneficial microorganisms. There is no reason why the seed has to be coated just with an organic chemical. It is also possible to coat them with beneficial microorganisms, which produce the right type of antibiotics, help the plant assimilate nutrients better, and also withstand drought and other stress attributes better, etc. And indeed, now there has been demonstration that you can coat the seeds of plants interesting microorganisms with these types of activities, and you can protect them against nematodes, insects, fungal diseases, and so on. So huge opportunity, and I think the sequencing technologies and the characterization that the genomic tools and the other tools of metabolomics, so forth, allow us to look into is going to play an important role in this context. You can see that there are also opportunities to bring some of these seed treatment technologies to emerging economies. Here is a list of countries, United States, European Union, which is a mix of all the Western European countries and India. Only 5% of India actually uses treated seeds. You can chemically treat them, reduce the amount of chemistry that we use in the seed, in the field, and also deliver better control. and there is an opportunity to use microbes in this context. And people are also using these tools to determine if we are transporting xanthomonas and other microorganisms from one place to another, so we can also have better attributes of the seed, not just from the perspective of the seed quality in terms of its genetics, but also in terms of these etiologic agents. There is a huge debate about food and fuel. And I wanted to bring that up to tell you that food and fuel, they can coexist. There is no reason to believe that the United States should only use its corn for animal feed and not use it for ethanol. It is my belief that it is possible to increase corn productivity substantially. If you are living in Brazil, you can improve sugarcane productivity substantially. If you are living in Malaysia, you can improve palm productivity substantially. We are tapping into somewhere between 25 to 40% of the potential that is already inherent in the genetics that is being sown, and there is opportunity to do more. So with that as the background, I would like to basically end my talk by telling you that there are indeed number of different opportunities in crop improvement, whether it is the nutrient content and quality, or whether it is related to the pest resistance, or whether it is related to nutrient responsiveness. There are huge opportunities there. But I should also mention to you that getting rid of sex in plants also can improve agricultural productivity. There are indeed technologies like apomixis, as well as better ways of hybridizing crops. So control sex and no sex is good in crop agriculture. I'm not talking about humans, but there are significant opportunities. Chemistry is going to play a role, but the cost of bringing chemistry into existence in agriculture is a very risky endeavor. Companies are making bets, but that bet is decreasing on a day-by-day basis. The cost of bringing a new agrochemical to the marketplace now is around $300 million in 15 years, which, of course, leads us to the question of who is financing innovation. And indeed, I think our financial systems are broken. We invest $320 billion on a global basis in life sciences. In agricultural technologies, we invest $10 billion, woefully small number in relationship to the size of the opportunities. Subsidies in agriculture are $250 billion. You know where the money is going in agriculture. We need to ask the question, are those subsidies warranted, especially at a time when there is a global shortage of food? So we need to figure out better ways of using these resources, the existing resources in and of themselves. Of course, there are some bright features, but I would like to end the talk by giving you one important message. The amount of sunlight that we receive on a daily basis just from sun is substantial. On an annualized basis, the amount of light that we receive from sun is actually 85,000 times more than the amount of energy that we as a global society consume. In fact, 1 hour of sunlight is the amount of energy that we use on a global basis. Only 1% of that sunlight is harvested by plants to produce the food and the biomass that we don't harvest. If we were to increase that from 1% to 2%, it is a wonderful machinery, a wonderful infrastructure that we have already put in place, and it becomes a huge system to capture sun's energy. And if we were to convert that into other forms of energy, whether it is electricity or whether it is liquid biofuels, it tells you that the opportunity is there. So there is no reason to worry about food versus fuel. There is no reason to worry about some of the other things that I talked about in terms of demand for food, because if we approach innovation the right way, there are indeed opportunities. We need to make sure that we have science-based policy making and science-based regulation in our dialogue. Thank you very much.